Sheikh Shafiq, is it permissible to have sexual intercourse during the first 10 days of Muharram, especially on the day of Ashura? Is it okay?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it is permissible for a man and his wife to drive all kinds of pleasures from each other, and of course sexual intercourse is one of them, and it is permissible on during Muharram, and even on the day of Ashura it is permissible. And it, of course, it's not considered to be a kind of disregard to Muharram, because it has nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, of course, it is permissible for a man and his wife, of course, to engage in sexual activity during the month of Muharram, and also during on the day of Ashura.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they have to make sure that you see that the man has to make sure that the wife is not in her menses. Otherwise, it's permissible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because sexual intercourse only when the wife is in her menses and the wife is in her nifas, childbirth, bleeding, or is not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's permissible.
Maybe it comes from this impression, or people are under some impression some areas because of their culture, because they have so much respect, for example, Imam Hussein and his disciples, his followers. And also, Muharram is one of the four haram months, in fact, in Islam. So they sort of think that this is kind of impermissible or haram, in fact, to have some sexual intercourse.
You're right. You know, people living in India, of course, they are under the impression that Muharram, the entire month, is a month in which a person cannot express any kind of joy. He cannot laugh, he cannot have any kind of sexual pleasure or physical pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And because they think, and this is their in judgment, of course, which is not correct, that physical pleasure, which is lawful, essentially,
mm-hmm.
is not halal in the month of Muharram, and therefore one should avoid it. But that's not the case.
Yes, this is some kind of a cultural invention imposed on Islam.
You're
basically
right.
It's not an Islamic issue or culture. How about fasting? Is it permissible to observe fasting or fast on the day of Ashura?
Well, I think we have discussed this in one of the previous episodes, and of course fasting is not haram on the day of Ashura, though there are many people who still continue to believe that fasting is not permissible on the day of Ashura, just as it's not permissible on the day of Eid al-Fitr or on the day of Eid al-Qurban. But it's not the case. Of course, it's permissible to keep fast on the day of Ashura, but it is not, recommended. It's mm-hmm. not recommended.
Yeah.
So it's makruh according to many scholars, according to many jurists and Shia mujtahid, to observe fast on the day of Ashura. And therefore, if a person has the need of fasting, it is better for him to break his fast after midday and to drink a cup of water or to eat something. But this is not the case with Sunni Muslims. You know, Sunni Muslims, they according to them, fasting is highly recommended on the day of Ashura. And you know, if you just look at the history, you can see that the Umayyad dynasty changed the calendar from the Rabi'ul Awal month, in which the Prophet migrated from mm-hmm. Medina to Mecca,
yes.
to Muharram. Otherwise, the lunar year actually begins during Rabi'ul Awal.
Yes.
But you know, the Umayyads, since they wanted Muslims to express joy in Muharram, and since they knew that Muharram was a time in which Imam Hussein was martyred,
yes.
so they wanted Muslims to express joy rather than joy and happiness rather than sadness. So they even changed the calendar, and since then, you know, Muharram became the first month of the lunar year,
mm-hmm.
and of course. They said that fasting is so recommended on this day, and That's not the case with Shia Islam, of course. Shia Muslims believe that this the holy day, the day of Ashura, is a very important day in the history of Islam and Muslims. And of course, it is not recommended. It is actually reprehensible to observe fast on this day.
To the best of my belief, I think the Shia school of thought only forbids fasting on 2 days.
On
one
2 days.
Is Eid al-Fitr, the real, the genuine Eid al-Fitr.
Sure.
Not the following, for example,
days
of celebration, for example.
Yes.
And also we have the Eid al-Qurban, right? Or Eid al-Adha.
You're right.
Okay.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
About Ashura and the Muharram, we know that in the Shia-dominated areas, even in some other countries where Islam is not prevalent, the Shias come out and they celebrate. They basically hold a lot of ceremonies.
You're right.
And about Ashura and the event of Muharram. Because of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein as his, faithful followers. Well, you know, and sometimes in those ceremonies, ladies, in fact, turn out.
Yes.
Is it permissible for the ladies to come and join those ceremonies? We know that also men, a lot of men, come out in those areas, and sometimes they take off their clothes to beat their chest, or even sometimes they use some chains to beat their backs with.
Yes.
All right. So, because they are somehow partly naked, is it permissible for the ladies to look at them?
It is permissible for ladies to come out and to commemorate the event of Ashura along with men, you know. So it is allowed per se, you know.
Yes.
As long as women are observe their hijab, they lower their gaze, and as long as men also do the same thing, they lower their gaze and do not and are confident that they will not fall into a sin or will not commit any haram act. So it is permissible for them to come out into the street and to actually commemorate the event of Ashura in these streets as a show of solidarity and unity and cohesion. It's very good for Muslims to come out into the streets, but it's important also at the same time that women should not look at men who take off their shirts and, of course, who lament and, of course, who beat their chests or maybe beat their backs with the chains. And, of course, women should not look at them, you know, you see. And, of course, if they are supposed to look, then they should not even come out into the street, because if they end up looking at men, and, of course, it's feared, that they might fall into a sin or maybe a kind of, let's say, feeling physical, they might get excited physically, and therefore that is not permissible, you know, permissible for
even
women.
If they don't have the fear?
But if of those, even if they don't have the fear, it's still not permissible for them to look at men who do not have shirts on, you know. It's not permissible for them. And there is also something to add, of course. During Muharram, we see that even women sing their songs, and maybe these are religious songs,
mm-hmm.
and they recite poems in their own languages, and sometimes they publish these or post these videos and,
mm-hmm.
and poems on their social networks and on social web pages, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Allowing other people to watch them.
Yes.
Of course, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it is not permissible for men to listen to such to these women who actually recite religious songs, you know.
Okay.
And it's also not permissible for women to publish and to upload these songs on their web pages.
Mm-hmm.
And on their on social networks, which will make them available for everyone.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Masked Zionist troops will still terrorize Palestinian children in the middle of the night, but new military jargon will hide the true purpose, says Jonathan Cook, journalist, in an article titled, Israeli regime's night raids on Palestinian families aren't over. Please stay tuned for the second part of the article. Even some former Zionist troops understand that the intelligence gathering rationales for these invasions are bogus. Several told the human rights groups that the intelligence supposedly gained from these operations was never put to later use. None could identify a database where the information was being stored. Even if the mapping raids were primarily about collecting information, the army has far more effective means to spy on and control the Palestinian population in the occupied territories of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The job of Unit 8200, one of the Israeli regime's military many intelligence gathering arms, includes listening in on Palestinian communications to find secrets that can be used to blackmail and extort Palestinians to collaborate with occupation authorities. A so-called cyber unit in Israeli regime's so-called justice ministry is tasked with spying on Palestinians' internet and social media communications. and the Zionist regime has endless other sources of intelligence on Palestinians. Collaborators, the Palestinian Population Registry, that it controls, biometric identity documents, face recognition technology, questioning at checkpoints, the use of drones, and the seizure of Palestinians for interrogation. More importantly, the army knows that it can continue as before with these home invasions by using other pretexts. It will subsume mapping operations within even more violent categories of night raids, such as the search for weapons, interrogations of children, about stoning, throwing, or arrest. Sadly, the Zionist regime courts have always shown a willingness to collude with the Zionist regime army in precisely these kinds of face-saving deceptions and cynical manipulations of language. There is no reason to believe that the Israeli regime legal system will do anything in practice to ensure that home invasions, whether for mapping or any other purpose, come to an end. The record of the Zionist regime courts has been consistently dismal in protecting Palestinians from Israeli regime army abuses. Even when the courts do belatedly rule against army protocols that flagrantly violate international law, the army invariably finds ways to undercut the ruling, usually with the court's complicity. For years, the army has continued to use Palestinians as human shields, dragging out legal proceedings by recharacterizing the practice as a so-called neighbor procedure or prior warning. It is not hard to imagine that intel mapping could be given a similar linguistic makeover. And there is an additional reason to be skeptical. More than 20 years ago, the Zionist regime top court banned the torture of Palestinian detainees, yet it continued almost unabated because the court created a loophole for cases defined as ticking bombs, when interrogators supposedly faced the race against time to extract information to save lives. After the ruling, it seemed that every Palestinian seized by the army became a ticking bomb. Finally, in 2017, the court reversed its 1999 ruling when it permitted torture as long as interrogators did not cross a threshold of pain that it declined to determine in advance. The reality is that when the Zionist regime treats its occupation as permanent, then preserving the occupation's infrastructure for surveillance, control, intimidation, and humiliation becomes an absolute necessity. When the occupier additionally seeks to drive out Palestinians to replace them with its own settler population, the rot runs deeper still. Palestinian men, women, and children are reduced to nothing more than pieces to be swept off a chessboard. For that reason, home invasions, the terrorizing of families in the middle of the night by masked troops, will continue, whatever euphemism is used to justify it.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Years of foreign-sponsored war in Syria has left more than 380,000 people dead. The UN says nearly 12,000 children have been killed or wounded so far. More than half of Syria's pre-war population of 22 million has fled their homes. Syria is in dire need of help, but surely the West has so far offered nothing but destruction and death to Syrians. The U.S. has targeted Syria with economic sanctions that have severely hit the war-torn country's economy by prohibiting foreign companies from trading with Damascus. Meanwhile, the U.S. and European countries had banned export and investment in Syria, as well as transactions involving oil and hydrocarbon products. Also, smuggling of strategic Syrian resources is another tactic used to put pressure on the government of President Bashar Assad, a move that has caused more instability. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government or a UN mandate. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. One example is the USAID operation into Idlib. The Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad has said the U.S. push to renew a cross-border aid operation into Syria's Idlib is aimed at supplying terrorist groups and prolonging the war. Meanwhile, Iran has once again underlined the need for a peaceful solution to the Syrian crisis.
We reiterate once more that the Syrian crisis must be settled peacefully and in accordance with principles of international law, particularly respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity of states, non-intervention and non-interference in their internal or external affairs, and peaceful settlement of international disputes.
Majid Takht-Ravanchi said the current situation in Syria is the result of foreign intervention as well as Israeli aggression. He warned that these issues can negatively impact regional stability and global peace and security. Damascus is determined to restore its sovereignty over the country's entire expanse. The Assad government has proved effective as Syrians continue to recapture key areas from remnants of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group and other foreign-backed terrorist factions across the country. Nevertheless, the presence of U.S. and European forces, in addition to Turkish troops, has slowed down its advances.
And President Assad has been on the forefront of the struggle against U.S. imperialism in the region. For many years, the U.S. has sought to dislocate, dismember, destabilize the Syrian nation. We saw this in 2011 through 2015, 2016, some of the roughest years of the U.S. funding Western-backed terrorists, Wahhabis trained and armed and funded by Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, the United States.
Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Bashar Assad. After failing to oust the Syrian government through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government stepped up its economic war on Syria by imposing crippling sanctions. Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, Joy Hood, warned countries in West Asia against restoring ties with Syria.
He also warned the prospect of sanctions against countries that normalize relations with Syria and do business with Damascus. Hood noted that the only way to achieve stability in Syria is through a political process. He also stated that Washington is committed to working with allies, partners, and the UN to ensure that a durable political solution remains within reach. That's why Washington and its allies are inside Syria without the invitation of the Damascus government or a UN mandate.
One of the biggest techniques of US imperialism is to create chaos and destabilization in a country that is anti-imperialist, that is against the empire, that defends its people. They create chaos there, and then they blame that chaos and destabilization on the policies of that government.
Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad called Washington's policy pure hypocrisy, citing wide-ranging U.S. sanctions against the war-torn Arab country. Maqdad further accused Western countries of killing Syrian people with their sanctions. Like it or not, Washington and its allies have failed to oust Bashar Assad, and his government is supported by the Syrian people. The presence of foreign forces in Syria is illegal and must end, as it is the root of instability in the country.
Tensions in the Black Sea are on the rise after a British Navy warship breached Russian territorial waters off the Crimean coast on Wednesday. Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement that Russia's Black Sea Fleet and the Russian Federal Security Service had stopped the violation of the state border by the British destroyer HMS Defender off Crimea's Cape Fyland. According to the ministry, the British military vessel ventured 3 kilometers into Russian territorial waters, prompting a Russian border guard patrol ship to fire warning shots and a Sukhoi 24M bomber to drop bombs in front of the destroyer. Following the warning maneuvers, the HMS Defender left the waters, but the British side denied that warning shots had been fired and that any bombs had been dropped in the path of the HMS Defender. Earlier in the day, Russia said hostile actions by the British warship near Russian territorial waters could not have been carried out without the U.S. green light.
I mean, in the sense that the U.S. and the U.K. are sending their fleet far away from home and obviously making provocative actions that are directly related to their interference in the internal affairs of Ukraine, yes, of course, the United States and the U.K. are guilty of these kinds of unwarranted provocations intended to create pressure on Russia. However, the fact of the matter is that these kinds of incidents are relatively common, and they can be expected. What the only unusual part here is that Russia is not backing down and is not giving in to the British pressure.
Russia has warned that it will defend its borders by all means, including with its military. Russia's foreign ministry has summoned the British ambassador to strongly protest what it called the British ship's violation of its territory. The ministry said it delivered a strongly worded protest to the envoy over the British Navy ship's, quote, provocative and dangerous actions. It said London would be fully responsible for any consequences if a similar incident happened again. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, however, defended the Navy ship's decision to navigate inside the Russian waters.
I think it was wholly appropriate to use international waters. And by the way, the important point is that we don't recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea. This is part of a sovereign Ukrainian territory. It was entirely right that we should vindicate the law and pursue freedom of navigation in the way that we take the shortest route between two points, and that's what we do.
Earlier this month, Russia announced a plan to boost its military presence along its western borders to counter increased NATO activities there. In the meantime, NATO has pressed ahead with its military drills near the Russian ground and maritime borders, a move that Moscow deems provocative.
The frequency with which the NATO, let's refer to the United States and the UK as the key NATO powers, the frequency at which they are doing this and the directness of their approach. There's no pretend here that there was an accident. This is an intentional heightening of military tensions, and it is intentional.
It appears that another Cold War between Russia and the West is likely to be on the horizon. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
Generations of horrific abuse of Indigenous people in Canada once again under the spotlight. A First Nations group in Saskatchewan province has revealed that the remains of hundreds of people, mostly children, were discovered at the site of a former Catholic boarding school there. Local Indigenous leaders want an inquiry into what they call genocide. The First Nations group said that the church that ran the residential school removed the headstones. The piece of tragic news came just weeks after the discovery of the remains of over 200 Indigenous children rattled the country. The latest finds have reopened old wounds in Canada about the notorious residential schools mostly operated by the Roman Catholic Church for the government of Canada. During the 19th and 20th centuries, 130 boarding schools forcibly separated more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their families. The program was aimed at assimilating Indigenous youth, but the schools subjected them to malnutrition and physical and sexual abuse. An estimated 6,000 First Nation kids died while attending these schools. Under mounting pressure, the Canadian government formally apologized for the system in 2008. However, despite growing calls, the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church have refused to apologize.
They're abrogating their responsibilities. By admitting their crimes, they're admitting that they're not following their own teachings. The crimes that they committed are so horrific, and children were beaten for simply speaking their own languages.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Thursday that he was terribly saddened by the new discovery. He said the trauma that Indigenous people feel is Canada's responsibility to bear. But has Ottawa really learned a lesson, and is it serious about alleviating the plight of First Nations? Canada is ranked among the world's seven largest advanced economies. The modern country, with one of the highest GDPs in the world, has long been a popular destination for millions of immigrants from across the globe seeking jobs and a better life. While Canada may sound like a dream world to many, it is far from a utopia for its own Indigenous population. Canada's 1.7 million Indigenous citizens, nearly 5% of the population, mostly live in isolated communities where poverty, high unemployment, and high rates of suicide are chronic problems.
There are psychological problems that have been passed down from generation to generation. Fathers who were in the generations in the residential schools and mothers suffered severe psychological problems because of the treatment they received. And that's just been passed down from generation to generation. And it's going to take years to correct that.
They have long complained that they are not getting a fair share of incomes from resources on their ancestral lands. Meanwhile, Aboriginal women have been subjected to deadly violence for many years. A national public inquiry concluded a few years ago that about 1,200 Aboriginal women have been murdered or gone missing in Canada since 1980. With activists putting the number much higher. Human rights groups have repeatedly raised the alarm about the situation of Canada's Indigenous population. Canada says it is ashamed of systemic racism, discrimination, and injustice that Indigenous peoples have faced. In 2017, the Canadian government acknowledged the humiliation, neglect, and abuse of First Nations and pledged to improve their lives. but First Nations are still struggling with a long list of problems and are fighting an uphill battle for their rights.
The United States has launched a wide-scale cyber crackdown on the websites of major news networks, mainly based in West Asia. In what appears to have been a coordinated operation, the domain for the websites was seized at a similar time late Tuesday night. Viewers visiting the sites have been met with the same notice from the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which reads, "This website has been seized. The domain has been seized by the United States government." The alleged legislation stated in the notice is too vague and wide to pinpoint exactly why the sites have been targeted. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, a total of 36 websites have been seized. Among the most prominent websites of news networks that have been targeted are Iranian-based news channels Press TV, Al Alam, and Al Kothar. In Yemen, the popular Al Masira news outlet that has been documenting Saudi Arabia's war on the country, along with other regional developments, has also been seized. Palestine Today is another, and the website of Lu'lu'a TV, an independent Bahraini news channel, was also captured. Washington took control of sites linked to news channels based in Iraq, too. These are mainly associated with the country's most important anti-terrorism security force, the Popular Mobilization Forces, the same branch of the Iraqi armed forces that spearheaded their victory against Daesh terrorists from 2014 to 2017. This has left many asking, where is America's so-called free speech and democracy?
This is not something that we should share. Somehow, it looks like freedom of expression and free speech has become the enemy rather than being or ally. And now the U.S. is blocking sites that are trying to provide information, that are trying to give another perspective and other view of the events that are happening worldwide.
All the news channels whose sites have been seized share something similar. Their narrative is different to that of news channels belonging to the United States and its allies. For example, they offered another side of the story to events unfolding in Yemen or Palestine. But how dangerous can that be when the United States does not provide viewers an alternative narrative to the news?
This is very dangerous. Without allowing other views and other narratives, the public cannot make, cannot make their minds. They cannot really understand the complexity of issues and have their own opinion about what is happening. Another danger is that we are in danger of manipulating, the information, manipulating reality.
Iranian-based websites are online like before under the domain .ir. For example, you can visit Press TV at presstv.ir. Yemen's Al-Masira.net was quick to open a new working website at almasira.com. Other channels are expected to follow suit in a similar fashion by changing their domain name. The Iranian presidential office says closing a number of our news websites is an unconstructive measure in light of the Vienna nuclear negotiations. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Saeed Khatibzadeh denounced the move as a systematic attempt by the U.S. to undermine freedom of expression on a global level and to silence independent voices in media. The Tehran-based Islamic Radios and Television Union says the U.S. seizure of dozens of websites is a shameful attack on rights of people across the world. The owners of the popular Ansar Allah movement have condemned the U.S. move, saying it signifies that these TV networks are influential and their activities have frightened the hegemonic regimes that claim to be advocates of freedom of speech. Critics say the U.S. administration's campaign to portray Iran and others in West Asia as destabilizing players in the region is aimed at benefiting America's military-industrial complex. They also say democracies should allow all voices to be heard and offer the viewer an opportunity to choose which narrative they wish to listen to.
delight.
Graduation is an exciting moment for all schoolgoers, but the occasion turns more joyful if it ends with a celebration like Scarlet Sales Festival, which is held in St. Petersburg in Russia at the end of the school year. The annual event is part of the famous White Nights Festival, traditionally held in summer with spectacular fireworks, numerous music concerts, and a massive water show. Normally, thousands of domestic and foreign tourists flock to the city to watch the colorful event. But this year, the COVID-19 pandemic limited the number of the attendees. The festival began in the 1960s when several Russian schools united to celebrate the end of the academic year. That is in connection with the symbolism of the popular 1922 children's book, Scarlet Sails, by Alexander Grin. Indonesia is dealing with a surge in coronavirus infections, but that has not stopped the people from observing the Yatnya Kasada Festival. Thousands of people braved the climb to the summit of Mount Bromo in eastern Java province to observe the ancient ritual. They made offerings ranging from fruits and crops to livestock by throwing the items to the pit of an active volcano. They believe the practice brings blessings and plenitude and helps them express gratitude for what they have. This year's festival was overshadowed by the coronavirus pandemic, with participants required to adhere to strict health protocols. China's space agency has released videos of its first Mars rover as it's exploring the red planet's surface. The rover is named Zhurong. It's now investigating a vast plane known as Utopia Planitia on Mars's northern hemisphere. The rover successfully landed on Mars in mid-May. It is studying the red planet's surface rocks and atmosphere. It also looks for signs of life, including any subsurface water or ice. The solar-powered Chinese robot weighs around 240 kilograms and has 6 wheels. China is the second country after the U.S. to operate a rover on Mars. A university in the Venezuelan capital Caracas has turned its roof into a garden and uses sustainable energy to light up its classes. The roof of Andres Bello Catholic University is covered with plants and 30 solar panels. The panels, along with a wind turbine, produce the 7,400 watts of electricity to illuminate that area and light 2 rooms in the building. The roof is now functioning as a self-sufficient and environmentally friendly open-air classroom. The proposal for the project was put forward by 2 students. The aim is to educate people about renewable energy and the threat of climate change.
A small New Hampshire town has been hit by a series of car break-ins over the last few weeks. People were shocked when they finally discovered the mischievous criminal. A large black bear has been identified as the bandit wreaking havoc in the town of Thornton. The naughty mammal was caught on camera as it got on its 2 hind legs and skillfully opened the door of a car. Police say the bear was most likely rummaging for food. Authorities have asked people to remove food from their cars to avoid enticing the troublesome animal. A Jordanian woman is receiving high demands for the soap she produces. Why? Because she uses an unusual ingredient. Lara Altiti makes soap out of camel milk. She tours different cities in Jordan to find the best camel farms for her business. Titi uses camel milk as the major ingredient for the soap she produces. That's because she says it has rich benefits and contains more vitamins than cow milks.
The first stage includes weighing the soap, and I include different kinds of oil to preserve the quality of the soap and its therapeutic benefit. We need to have high foam and tough consistency, and we don't want it to be rancid. We place high importance on the therapeutic material that we add during the production process.
Titi started her soap line at home using a manual process and then expanded it to an independent workshop. Her soap line has now become very popular in Jordan. Titi produces more than 4,000 soap bars a month. She tells them to both sells them both to domestic and international customers.
If you're a car lover, this story is for you. Over 300 classic vehicles have taken part in a retro rally across Estonia. The 1,000-kilometer rally kicked off in the town of Perde. It drew participants from Latvia and Finland. Their motto is Straight Ahead to the Past. The vintage cars participated in the event are mostly produced between 1930 and 1980. Experts say all the vehicles are in good condition. However, they doubt if all the vehicles can make it to the end of the five-day rally.
The German firm's electric air taxi takes its first flight at a show in an airport near the French capital, Paris. Volocopter's flying taxi, which looks like a tiny helicopter, took off and landed vertically over the airport with no passenger on board during a three-minute trial. Aside from its two-passenger capacity, the aircraft also has some room for luggage. It flew a 500-meter route at speeds of up to 30 kilometers per hour and 30 meters high along the airfield. The flying taxi service would first be operated by a licensed pilot, but the flight would be fully automated over a period of time.
With respect to regulation, initially we will have a fully certified, fully licensed helicopter pilot, just to fit into existing regulation. But we believe over time it can be much simpler to obtain such an operating license for a volocopter. And of course, in the last instance, we want to take a pilot requirement out, and we want these vehicles to fly fully automated. So you will not need a pilot license anymore. You can just summon the volocopter, it will come and pick you up and bring you safely to your destination.
The German firm is entering the urban mobility market with high hopes of playing a major role in the infant industry. Volocopter says its objective is to have a service in operation for 2024 for the 2024 Olympic Games. Walking around the city without shoes can be delightful. If you're interested in the experience, visit the Russian capital. A 3.5-kilometer long barefoot trail has recently opened in Moscow's Elk Island Park. It's made of various materials such as pine bark, beach pebbles, and clay. Taking around 40 minutes to complete, the path attracts hundreds of visitors every day. However, some people find it difficult to walk without shoes, calling the path a torture trail. A zoo in Turkey has welcomed a baby elephant from an endangered species. The birth of a female calf at Izmir Wildlife Park has caused excitement in keepers and visitors. The calf, yet to be named, is the third offspring of parents from Asian species. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature classifies the Asian elephant as endangered due to their rapid decline in the wild. The Asian elephants are primarily threatened by poaching, fragmentation, and loss and degradation of habitat. Currently, around 20 to 40,000 Asian elephants are living across the world, five of which inhabiting Turkey's Izmir Zoo.
Palestinian artist has come up with the idea of making children feel happy after the recent Israeli aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip left many people dead.
Amna Sami is a young Palestinian artist who has gathered Palestinian kids in the city of Beit Lahia, north of Gaza. That's where houses were destroyed by Israeli airstrikes and bombings during the recent aggression on the territory. Sami draws the Palestinian flag as well as the map of Palestine on children's cheeks as patriotic symbols. She says she does that to say that these people in the midst of destruction will become strong again. Sami says by painting on kids' faces, she wants to send a message to the world.
I'm sending a message to the world that our children should live like other children in the world, away from danger and destruction. It is their right in life to live as children in a safe place, a place that gives them something to live a normal life.
Palestinian kids say they feel happy when Sami paints their faces. The Israeli regime launched its devastating onslaught on Gaza in early May. At least 256 Palestinians, including 66 children, were killed during the 11-day war. A Turkish band has found musical inspiration in a most unlikely place, a local landfill. Here's more. Members of Funk Istanbul have assembled instruments from the dump in a junkyard in Istanbul. They use their ingenious new tools to play Turkish folk music. The band aims to raise awareness about recycling. Turkey is one of the biggest producers of municipal waste globally. The country has a low recycling rate. Only 12% of waste is repurposed there.
Technology has come in handy to rescue animals in disaster zones. American cinematographer Douglas Thron has used a high-tech infrared drone to save animals from fire or storm, or even those who are stuck in trees. The drone he uses has a large thermal camera, a spotlight, and zoom lens. The good point is that the aerial vehicle does not make too much noise. Therefore, it does not scare away animals.
So what I do is I fly infrared drones primarily at night over disaster areas after a hurricane or a fire hits, and I look for people's pets, whether it be cats or dogs, and I also look for injured wildlife, and then either I or rescue crews will go in and rescue the animals after I spot the animals after these natural disasters.
Thron has so far rescued hundreds of stranded animals in various places in the US and Australia. Emergency services have allowed him to participate in rescue efforts after making sure that the drone works well to achieve its goal.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A video has gone viral showing animals at a U.S. zoo enjoying their bath time becoming clean as a new pin. Keepers at Chicago's Brookfield Zoo washed the animals to celebrate International Bath Day. From anteaters to rhinos all got sprayed with a water hose. They seemed to love their bath time as it kept them cool in the summer heat. Zoo officials say the occasion is to honor ancient Greek scientist Archimedes, who made a discovery while in the bath. You might be pleased to know life is going back to normal as countries around the world are easing coronavirus restrictions. Disneyland in the French capital, Paris, is saying bonjour to visitors once again with all necessary precautions. Bet everyone missed that. The theme park reopened its doors to the public with limited tickets and an online reservation system. All visitors over 6 years old are required to wear face masks and to observe social distancing guidelines. New attractions, including a hotel and various car rides, are also available for guests.
Disneyland Paris was shut for over 7 months due to rising COVID-19 infections. This is the first time since January 2020 that all the six Disney resorts are open. Children have their own ways of remembering the dead. In Gaza, Palestinian kids fly kites in memory of their peers who lost their lives in the recent Israeli onslaught. Dozens of kids participated in the event, holding kites bearing the pictures of 66 little victims. According to the organizers, the goal was to send a message to people around the world that Palestinian kids have the right to live a free and happy life. The children said their dream is to fly in the sky without any restrictions or wars. A herd of wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
Chinese grandma has given a dazzling display of her masterly kung fu performance at a martial arts competition. The 98-year-old woman and her son took the stage as a curtain raiser to the event. The duo put on a kung fu show before a large crowd of spectators who were impressed by her skillful gestures. She was invited to the competition to act as a judge.
I started practicing martial arts when I was only five. I would box every day, learning movements like chopping, pushing palm, and thrusting palm. Though I am old now, my strength hasn't gone.
Zhang says she's inherited her family's martial arts. She's rumored to have a sense of justice from a very young age and try to help others, which earned her quite a reputation where she lives. Traditional martial arts have been passed down in the Zhongqing village located in Zhejiang province for 500 years.
IRIB English Radio.